Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
And his other half, making his long-awaited debut on the podcast, Rob Hatch.
Hello, hello.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis, we've got the big talking points covered.
Rob, the happy couple here have got wonderful news. You've moved in together. How's that happened, Rob and Daniel?
Can we just go straight on to Astana? I'd rather talk about that.
Astana. So we're going to talk today about the latest controversy engulfing Astana, or Astana. Rob, you pronounce it Astana. Can you explain? Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes, I've been to Kazakhstan, and I had to look it up. So yes, it's Astana, apparently.
Astana. Well, we might have more kind of conversation on pronunciation issues during the podcast, because Lionel and Rob had a bit of a spat on Twitter during the year about pronunciation, didn't you?
I wouldn't say it was a spat. We had a minor disagreement.
How does the US marketing guy pronounce it?
Hey, you just got to talk the language of the common people, man.
Okay, moving on. Right, so I'm back. And well done, fellas. I listened to the podcast while I was away. Great effort all round.
You don't need to sound so patronising.
You did very well. Lionel, although I do have a question to ask you, if we're going to have a truth and reconciliation commission of our own, that cat did not sound Belgian to me.
It was the Belgian cat. It definitely was.
Lionel, I think that was your cat.
That may have been my cat.
Okay, Astana, right, as we speak, this story is going to develop over the course of the week, isn't it? Gazzetta dello Sport reporting today, as we speak Monday, that Dr. Michele Ferrari attended an Astana training camp. Daniel, what can you tell us about this?
Well, it's quite a long, convoluted, complicated story, as they usually are on the podcast. I think it's worth going back in time just to talk about where and when Vinokourov's links with Ferrari date back to. And not to blow my own trumpet, but I almost broke this story with a German journalist in 2007, because the German journalist in question, Christian Harth, his name was, he had seen Vinokourov in Tenerife, and this is where we're going to come to Rob in a minute, because he knows Tenerife very well, with Ferrari. He'd seen Vinokourov and Ferrari in the spring of 2007 together on the Teide volcano. And the German journalist informed me, we worked on a story together, and we kind of confronted Astana with this on the eve of the tour. Naively, I think I did it on the Thursday, and I was writing the story on the Saturday. I should have done it on the Friday night, really. And Vinokourov the next day phoned up his favourite journalist at L'Equipe, Philippe Legault, and gave an interview. I'm with Ferrari, so what? So he sort of preempted the story. And since then, his links with Ferrari have been very well known, haven't they? And he tested positive for a blood transfusion in 2007 Tour de France. And there have been a lot of rumours since then, haven't there? Sorry, Lionel.
Well, we should just explain a little bit for those who perhaps haven't been following the sport since 2006 and before, who Dr. Michele Ferrari is and why he's such a controversial and divisive figure in cycling.
Well, Dr. Ferrari is pretty much synonymous with the EPO generation, isn't he? He's been the subject of various investigations over the years, and of course, most famously, most sort of notoriously, he was Lance Armstrong's doctor of choice throughout his Tour de France winning reign. Anyway, talk about Armstrong. The Armstrong investigation, USADA investigation, where there have been files exchanged with the Italian magistrate in Padova, Padua, as we're supposed to call it in English, who's been working on this investigation for several years. And there's now a 550-page dossier, which has just been passed to the Italian Olympic Committee. And that is the basis for these reports in La Gazzetta, but also the basis for an even more detailed report in La Repubblica yesterday on Sunday, which had a lot of information suggesting that Ferrari has been very active. He's been working with, this is allegations I should stress, working with as many as 12 riders from Astana. Nibali himself personally is not mentioned, but his coach Paolo Slongo, who's been his coach since his Liquigas days, so since 2007, he is mentioned. He supposedly, according to what La Repubblica have said, according to what this report says, has frequent contact with Ferrari. And then added to that is the revelation in, again, plucked from the Padova investigation or files to do with that. The revelation that Ferrari attended or visited riders that he knows at an Astana training camp in Monte Catini in Tuscany in 2013, November 2013.
Rob?
It's a mess, isn't it? It's a right old mess. We find ourselves here again when most of us hoped, I know that some people like the entertainment of it all, but most of us hoped that we wouldn't be here, certainly in our position, having to talk about it and dissect it and be careful what we talk about. But this report that's come out in La Repubblica this weekend that Daniel, thanks to our new beautiful arrangement, passed me this morning.
Over the breakfast table.
Over the breakfast table, darling, yes. And there are a few quotes in it that supposedly come from riders. One supposedly comes from Michele Scarponi saying, well, do you think I could have won the Giro in 2010? Yes, with another bag you could have done, is supposedly, again, allegedly, we'll keep using that word. The reply from Michele Ferrari, so that doesn't look good for Scarponi, who now is with Astana, of course. Great rider to watch on the road, lovely guy in his interviews and everything, but if he's been a cheat again, then we're entered the second and last, third perhaps, last chance saloon for him. It's not looking good for a lot of people. The quotes go on, Diego Caccia talks about things as well. We've had quotes from Ferrari Jr. talking about taking young riders under his wing, and perhaps the next generation, which we hope will be a little cleaner, might, unfortunately, be involved in this sort of thing.
What's amazing is Ferrari's appetite for it all as well. His determination to be at the heart of the sport, if this is true. You would think that given the sort of notoriety that is attached to his name, that he would sort of slink into the shadows permanently. But if this is true, then he obviously wants to remain as this sort of kingmaker within the sport.
Yeah, and he's also this kind of lust he has, this hunger he has for that involvement, seems to have contaminated his son as well, because his son Stefano appears to be an integral part of his business. Stefano supposedly, well, this was reported by a friend of the podcast, Anders from VG in Norway, has been renting an apartment in Monaco, which is of course is where Alexander Vinokourov is based. Stefano was the conduit to Lance Armstrong during his comeback in 2009-2010. So yeah, I mean, I spoke this morning to another guy who's involved, heavily involved, or certainly mentioned on numerous occasions in the report, is a guy called Raimondo Scimone, who's an agent of a lot of riders, and he's the subject of allegations that he orchestrated a kind of a money laundering scheme involving Ferrari and also involving doping. Anyway, I spoke to him this morning. He says he knows nothing of these allegations today in La Gazzetta, but he was absolutely staggered, or he proclaimed to be staggered, that Ferrari would turn up at training camp in 2013. You know, even incognito, even in the dead of night, even, you know, when no journalists are present. It's a risky undertaking, isn't it?
I was talking to a cycling team doctor over the weekend at the Track World Cup, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. And this idea also that guys can still be doing blood doping, that sort of heavy-duty blood doping, blood transfusions and so on. He was saying that if doping is going on, and doping is clearly still going on, we're talking more about micro-dosing. But micro-dosing confers micro-gains, micro-benefits. It's not perhaps the game-changer that it once was. So, you know, but the involvement of Ferrari suggests that, you know, that sort of heavy duty stuff is still going on. Just on Astana as well, do you like the pronunciation there, Rob? You know, when Maxim Iglinski tested positive, Nibali sort of explained it as that he was a peripheral member of his core group for the tour, that he hadn't been a member of that group that went to Tenerife and so on. But, you know, if this is true, then it's not just Nibali, it's guys like Fuglsang, who's always been a pretty eloquent and articulate guy on the subject of doping. Louis Westra, who I interviewed during the tour for the podcast on these sorts of subjects. You know, are all these guys caught up in this?
Well, I think the situation we've found ourselves in since the tour is trying to give Astana the benefit of the doubt. You know, we've been working to try and, you know, look at each individual case in, you know, without sort of conferring on Astana that they've got some kind of team-wide doping effort going on, and just from the, I mean, the more that all this comes out, the more ludicrous my sort of 5-minute interview with Vinokourov on the second rest day comes, because clearly if Ferrari was at an Astana training camp in November 2013 and he stood there telling everybody that doping doesn't go on in his team, I mean, you know, those two points are not compatible with one another. Will remains to be seen how much of this comes out and is confirmed, but if there's an investigation that is so wide-reaching and the allegations are so wide-reaching, it really rides a coach and horses through any protestations from Vinokourov and the team that they're not involved in all of this.
Yeah, that's what you say there, Lionel, something that I can really identify from my position behind the microphone. Yeah. Of course, we have to call a race as we see it. We can't say, oh, I'm not sure about this performance, I'm not sure about that performance, because at the end of the day, a race is a race, and we assume that if somebody's racing, they have the right to be there and everything's fair and competitive, within reason, of course. We can't sort of call out somebody we might suspect to be a doper at the time, so I might be made to look a little stupid by calling somebody home who's in the end resulted to have doped. And I think that goes for everybody who's involved with the sport as well. They wanted to believe what they were seeing on the television, and I still want to believe what I'm seeing on the television, but if there are these suspicions, for once, it would be really nice if they were investigated transparently, properly, and in the public eye as well.
I mean, and just one thing on the kind of fragmented picture at Astana. I mean, one reason why we gave Nibali the benefit of the doubt was that the impression was that it was a very sort of divided camp, in the sense that there was very much a Kazakh block and an Italian block. And Vinokourov, we know, is the one who has the historical links with Ferrari. But we thought that perhaps Nibali, his direct sportive Martinelli, Slonga, there have been various murmurs about all of those people, but we hope that they remain distant from all of that. That could perhaps not be the case. But also, one interesting little footnote, something that came out of the Repubblica report yesterday. Giovanni Visconti is a well-known client of Michele Ferrari. He was suspended for having had some kind of coach-athlete relationship with Ferrari a couple of years ago, but there is an intercepted telephone conversation between Ferrari and Visconti in which Ferrari is trying to persuade him not to take a doping product. He suggests that Visconti didn't need it. Visconti was putting pressure on Ferrari to take this product before the 2010 World Championships.
It's interesting that, because you know, the Ferrari clearly is synonymous with doping, as you say, but he's also, according to those who have worked with him, this phenomenal coach and this phenomenal sort of planner of training programs.
Yeah, there are more facets to what he does just than the doping. That's something that's really important, I think, to point out.
I mean, you know, conceivably, if he's advising athletes not to dope, conceivably he might have cottoned on to the fact that finally the biological passport improved testing has leveled the playing field a little bit, and that it's far more difficult to do the sort of doping that went on in the past, and therefore you play according to the new parameters of the game.
But isn't one of the things that came out of all of the Armstrong stuff the fact that the more money you pay, the better the program you get from Dr. Ferrari, you know, and that you get access to greater knowledge and greater plans and better medicines the more you pay, and that there's a hierarchy amongst the dopers as well. And I think that's where it is so murky, it's so difficult to kind of unpick. And when you see, I mean, all of this will come out in the wash in the coming days, I'm sure, but when you see the scale of the allegations, let's not forget, you know, Ferrari really has no place coaching anybody. So
he's not allowed to coach anyone.
There's a really interesting line actually this morning in the Gazzetta dello Sport. It's the one at the Gazzetta dello Sport that stood out to me as a sort of bizarre line all on its own. And if you're a member of the Italian Cycling Federation, if you have a membership card, you are by the rules bound and obliged to report when you see Dr. Ferrari, Dr. Legend as they call him, with anybody from the cycling community.
Even you, Lionel, if Dr. Ferrari was to walk in here now and we saw him in your company, we'd be obliged to report that.
I'm beyond any help. So.
Well, Rob Hatch is the one with links to Tenerife. Aren't you, Rob?
Better not go there undercover anymore, had I?
Right, listen, shall we wrap up there with the Astana chat? We'll come back in a moment and talk about the Track World Cup. Daniel's nodding off already.
Well, we'll return to the Astana story in future weeks. I don't think it's going to go away, is it?
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freen.
Just time to let you know about a live event we're doing in a couple of weeks' time. The Cycling Podcast Live will be held at the Velo House in Tunbridge Wells in Kent on December the 17th in the evening. Richard, Daniel and myself will be there discussing the whole cycling season and taking questions from the floor. Tickets are £12 and the website you need to check out all the details is www.thevelohouse.com. Hopefully see you there.
So we're going to talk about the Track Cycling World Cup, but just quickly, Rob corrected me on my naming of Tenerife as this place synonymous with, well, not, you know, it does have these links with Ferrari in the past, but you were making a point about Tenerife, Rob.
I agree with you in it, to a certain extent that it has been synonymous with doping, unfortunately, as much as my Canarian pride would like me to suggest otherwise, but it's got a great climate. A lot of people go and train down there. You get in La Santa and Lanzarote as well for the Ironmen and triathlete people. But there's been a suggestion in the past that it was too hard to get to for the testers. That's not an excuse for WADA. They should have somebody employed down there. And this isn't just a cycling thing. There's a lot of athletes go down, marathon runners who go and train down there. It's an easy place to get to. There are two airports on the island. There are more flights than London than from Madrid. You can get to from anywhere in the world. WADA should be using some sort of intelligence to get these people. And they all seem to stay in the same hotel as well, don't they, yeah. Daniel? You were saying that.
One interesting thing. I mean, we're going to talk about Track World Cup. The track, British track team are going there this week, actually. The men's and women's endurance squads. There's also this question of whether you need to test athletes when they're training. For the biological passport, obviously, it doesn't really matter if it's now or in 2 weeks' time. You can also, this is what was being pointed out to me by a doctor at the weekend, have strange anomalies when you test people at altitude, as Team Sky discovered with Sergio Henao. So there may be reasons to not test athletes while they're at altitude, because it might play havoc with the biological passport readings, perhaps, if there are those fluctuations, anomalies at altitude. Daniel, you're looking
at Well, just on a related point, we were talking about Ferrari and this kind of paradox of, again, according to La Repubblica yesterday, it being fairly common knowledge among riders. I should stress it's not really among journalists. There have been murmurings that he might still be active, but according to what they say yesterday, a lot of riders still know him. You know, they still refer to him by a nickname, Pippo Baldo, who's this really gaudy naff Italian game show host. Anyway, but if this is common knowledge among the sort of clique of riders, trainers, etc., yeah, it also begs the question of maybe WADA, maybe UCI need to use kind of undercover intelligence a bit more. We talked about Tenerife. You know, would it be impossible to have someone working in one of those? Well, there's really only one hotel that pro bike riders go to, or someone who is able to kind of observe and monitor the comings and goings in and out of that hotel. You know, use intelligence like that, perhaps.
Also, Tinkoff Sachs at the minute are down in Gran Canaria. That's where I used to live, and it's everybody on the island, 800,000 people on the island, everybody knows where they're staying. They've got a sponsor. The name of the hotel is on Tinkoff Sachs's jersey. People know that they're going to go down there in winter. Send somebody down there.
They are wearing camouflage, though.
Apparently they are, yeah.
Right, shall we move on? Shall we move on to the Track World Cup? Because Rob and I were there at the weekend. Daniel, stay with us here. Stay with us. Okay, so Rob was commentating. I was there observing and watching and writing a little bit. Now, one of the interesting things for me was how, you know, the Track World Cups, when they're held in Britain, tend to be very popular. It's the first one held in London. We've had them in Manchester, usually also in Glasgow. It wasn't a full house for all the sessions. Now, it is a bigger venue than those other two, but this is a sport with real problems. If they can't sell out the venue in Britain, they'll not sell out anywhere. And I gather that the event was operating at a loss in six figures. £200,000 was the figure I heard for the deficit for a three-day event. You know, they have to put all the riders up, all the teams up in hotels for 4 or 5 nights, which brings about a £200,000 hotel bill. So it's unsustainable. Next year, Olympic year, there are currently no host venues for any of the Track World Cups. No doubt one of those will be held in the UK. There's rumours that Australia and New Zealand will, one of those, that they'll sort of host a joint World Cup. But it's got real, real problems. And only today the IOC have met and they've changed the way that the Olympic Games will be organised. It'll be events-based rather than sports-based. So there'll be more flexibility on which sports can come in and out of the programme. and there will be also flexibility in which events can be held. Now, velodromes are quite expensive. The next Olympics in Rio, they'll be committed already to, well, they might not have built the velodrome yet, but they're not probably committed to building a velodrome there. Tokyo, you know, track cycling is pretty big in Japan, so no doubt there'll be a velodrome in Tokyo. But beyond that, you know, you look at some of the potential places where the Olympics could go, and you wonder if, you know, Athens, for example, would have built a velodrome. So it's got real problems. I was speaking to Ian Dyer, the sprint coach, or actually the sort of coaching coordinator now at British Cycling, and he's got some pretty radical ideas for rejigging the whole competition. You know, there was one...
Have it outdoors and not on a track.
I'll do it. No, but the
really work.
Well, I mean, one of the sessions that was particularly tested the endurance of even the most diehard fans was the team pursuit qualifying. 43 teams were up for team pursuit qualifying in men's and women's. You know, that is... Yeah, and there were rounds and rounds of pursuit qualifying as part of the Omnium, as part of the, you know, it's not the most entertaining thing to watch. So it does need, I don't know if that was your impression as well, Rob.
I thought there was a lot of it.
I mean, you were doing your best to make it as exciting as possible, obviously.
Thank you very much. I was there as a guest commentator for a day, filling in for the final day, just on the Sunday, because the normal commentator was unavailable. We were there for 9 hours. I thought the main events, the finals, they were fantastic fun. They were great. The velodrome was sold out in the evening session, but as you say, in the morning session, admittedly, we had a very early start of around 8 a.m. in the morning, so Sunday morning, not many people are going to turn up on a cold, rainy Sunday morning in London. Certainly with Christmas coming, in the midst of an economic crisis as well, it all costs money. All those qualifying events, though, there must be some way of rejigging those. You're right, if you've got qualifying for team pursuit, we had qualifying... about 1.5 hours qualifying for the sprints, flying lap. And, yeah, it's great to watch if you're a pure cycling fan and you like the numbers and the power, but to the casual average fan, it was a little too much, I thought. Maybe stretching out over more days would have been better, and having less forced on you per day, I thought, might have been certainly a better approach. But just condensed it, less is more sort of thing.
I think this is a creeping problem that we've seen coming over the last number of years, and certainly my trip to the Ghent 6 really throws into...
You went to the Ghent 6, did you, Lionel?
I went to the Ghent 6, yeah. Yeah, they had a special podcast 2 episodes ago. You can listen to my report from the Ghent 6. But throws into sharp focus the difference between a track competition that's put on purely for entertainment's sake, get the crowd involved. There doesn't have to be the slavish adherence to performance that there does at the World Cup. But the World Cup program, by comparison, it always feels like a bit of a plod. The World Championships is slightly better. It's over 5 days rather than 3, and so you don't have that, as you're saying, Richard, you know, hours of men's team pursuit qualifying followed by hours of women's team pursuit qualifying followed the next day by the Omnium men's individual pursuit, Omnium women's individual pursuit. There's a lot of the same kind of... And really what it is that gets people interested and excited in the venue itself is the sprint matches, the finals and the Madison. I mean, the Madison as a television event is a dead loss. I mean, you are watching it on the TV, the Madison... It's very, very hard to get a handle on what is actually happening on the track. But when you're actually there and you can focus on it for 25 minutes, half an hour, it's a great, really absorbing race to watch. And that's what the Madison chases and the points races in the Ghent 6 are like. And the crowd are really, they are absorbed. Certainly the ones sitting in the seats, perhaps not the ones in the middle at Ghent. But then I think people were tweeting pictures of the centre of the track and all the VIPs eating their lunches. And I think Michael Hutchinson tweeted a picture of the menu to sort of point out this disparity between the athletes, you know, putting on their show and the VIPs having a nice 3-course meal. But, you know, that's the reality of modern sport, isn't it? That's what makes the world go round.
That's what brings in the money, although obviously... Not
Tour
enough.
The last few years, hence the reason the Tour of Flanders was moved, because as great a race as it is, it was just unable to survive financially where the finish was before. At the minute, it's on a dual carriageway, a wide stretch road, and they can fit all the VIPs in. Simple mathematics.
On the track racing itself, I mean, you mentioned the Madison there. There was a terrific win by the young British riders, Owen Doull and Mark Christian, on Saturday evening. Owen Doull, who's turned down a contract offer from Europcar, I spoke to him. Actually, we'll hear from him in a few minutes. And that was a great race. They took a lap and defended it. It was exciting to watch, and it is amazing when you're there just how many of the in the crowd are obviously able to follow it and really do understand what's going on, because it isn't easy. Also, Laura Trott once again, you know, helped the Team Pursuit girls to a gold medal when they really began to look pretty ragged over the last few laps. She steadied the ship and helped them to hold on to their lead, and they won the gold medal there. And then she was terrific again in the Omnium. I mean, she's just a brilliant bike racer to watch, and we'll also hear a little bit from her. Jason Kenny, the men's sprinters were disappointed from a British point of view. Jason Kenny is the great enigma. He is obviously Olympic champion, and he was Olympic team sprint champion in Beijing as well, where he was also second in the Kieran, wasn't he? Sorry, in the sprint in Beijing. But he's out with the Olympics. He doesn't seem to be the same athlete at all. And I spoke to Ian Dyer about that, and he was saying that he struggles really because he's quite slight. He struggles to keep on the sort of muscle bulk that he needs. Racing diminishes him, literally. He performs well at the Olympics because he has a 3 or 4 month block leading into the Olympics where all he does is train. And when he has to race regularly, he just cannot keep the sort of body shape that he needs. And he does a lot in the gym and all rest of it, but he can't do that when he's tapering for a race. So that was quite interesting how, you know, the Jason Kenny that you get in August or September is very different to the Jason Kenny that you see competing February, March time, January, February, March.
I was just changing the subject slightly back to what you said before, Richard. What were some of Ian Dyer's innovative ideas to try and reinvigorate the track program? Because I think we can all agree. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, the sprint competition, particularly in the World Cups, could you not have sort of little knockout groups of three where you get, you know, Jason Kenny in a group with two other riders and they all have a race against each other, 2 points for a win, nothing for a defeat?
This sounds a bit like the Champions League. You hate the Champions League. You railed against the Champions League last in last week's podcast, didn't you? Or was that US marketing guy?
Yeah, but this we're talking about trying to put
US
on
this marketing guy revamp track racing.
Have it outdoors on Alpe d'Huez, just like Daniel says. The kid's got form.
Right. Well, I'm not sure that I can actually share Ian Dyer's radical ideas. They were very radical, but he has put them to a wider group of coaches. I think we should probably get him on at some point to explain them. I'm not sure that he wanted them publicly aired, so I can only hint at them.
Interjecting as someone who obviously doesn't follow track racing that closely, last week we talked about this obsession with imposing a narrative on the road cycling season. It always strikes me that the Track World Cup is a very disparate, kind of ad hoc, difficult to follow series.
Yeah, maybe there does need to be some kind of overarching, you know, national. But I mean, the one of the other problems is that the British, when they turn up in force, they do tend to dominate, and you know, nothing with one nation dominating it tends to be terribly compelling.
I mean, thankfully, for those who like competition, may have changed slightly this week, and the Colombia turning up with a couple of fantastic young riders, Fabian Puerta, brilliant yesterday, Venezuelans doing well as well, and maybe that is a bit of a problem with the sport. The Brits are so good at it that it's only really a big sport in Great Britain. There aren't many countries where people will see track cycling as a big sport. Spain, given an example where I'm quite knowledgeable about, doesn't even register on the map.
Shall we hear a few very quick fire interviews from people I spoke to over the weekend? We've got Heiko Salzwedel, who's come back to British cycling. He's a sort of there's a new sheriff in town, is how Shane Sutton described him. We can also hear a little bit from Brian Cockard, the Europe car rider who's also a silver medalist at the Omnium in London 2012. Owen Doole we'll hear from as well. We'll just play those one after the other. Here's Heiko, Brian Cockard, and Owen Doole.
And Laura Trott.
Oh, and Laura Trott as well. Just a bit of Laura Trott at the end. Heiko, you're back at British Cycling. What's it like to be back?
It's a great feeling, actually. And, you know, the grass is always green on the other side. When you see when you're inside British Cycling, you don't really appreciate what a great organization this is. But when you're looking at British Cycling from the outside, it's a very professional organization. I'm very happy to be a part of this again.
Does it feel the same, or have there been a lot of changes since you left?
Yeah, it's totally different, actually. It's actually my third time with British Cycling in the last 15 years. The first time was the humbling beginnings with Peter Keane. Then I came back in 2008 after the biggest medal haul in history of cycling or of the sport. So at my second time, I didn't really feel I could contribute much because everything was set in line, everything was perfect. But now as a third time, I come in a little bit different position. The last times I came as a manager, now I come as a coach. And as a coach, you have always some ideas. And sometimes it's refreshing to bring some new ideas. Not necessarily better ideas, but fresh ideas. Mm. And this is where I see my point here, and I think I can contribute quite well.
And what is your first time at British Cycling without Dave Brailsford as the figurehead, as a man in charge, or one of the men in charge? What's it like in his absence? Does he leave a bit of a vacuum behind, or has that been filled?
I don't feel that at all. I mean, I worked with Dave, or Dave worked with me many, many years. We've been a very good team, and it was great to work under his leadership. But now with Shane, I think a lot of people underrate him. I mean, Shane was already preparing a lot of decisions before when he was second man in charge. So now he's the first man in charge, and everybody is surprised. But for me, it's no surprise, but because I know how that worked in the past.
And I mean, we're obviously looking ahead to the Rio Olympic Games. Some talk about maybe Mark Cavendish coming into the squad riding the Omnium. You know Cavendish very well. You in fact, helped launch his professional career with T-Mobile way back 2007. Your relationship with Mark, is it still quite strong? Are you going to speak to him about coming into the fold for Rio?
Definitely. This is actually one of the most exciting parts here. All these kids who are now most of these kids who are now interesting for the Rio Olympics for Great Britain, I worked with them 15 years ago. Like with Ed Clancy or Mark Cavendish, I did the interviews when they applied for the Academy program, yeah, as little kids. And now they are big heroes, and it's nice to come back here. Also Bradley Wiggins, yeah, or Ben Swift. You name them, yeah? So from that point of view, I'm feeling very comfortable in that position because I know them from the early beginnings for over many years.
Brian, do you enjoy coming back to the track, riding on the track, and happy memories here from the London Olympics as well?
Yes. The Olympics track is very lot of good moments for me. My favorite, my best moment in cycling, it's in London, and I'm very happy to come back here for my comeback in track.
Do you feel that riding on the track helps you on the road as well? Does it make you a better road sprinter as well?
Yeah, I think track is very good for road, and come back in track because they have world championships in France. And for me, it's a big season objective for me and for my team. And for this season, I have two objectives: World Championship track and Tour de France.
And well, that presumably you want to go to the Rio Olympics as well. So how do you balance track and road over the next 2 years?
I don't know. I don't know. Omnium is very difficult, and training for Omnium with road, I think it's very difficult. But my statue progress in team and Europa. I think Europa don't like. I go in Olympic. We have Thomas Bouda, World Championship for Omnium, and see it's very difficult, but maybe.
It's just fun, you know, and I think the crowd enjoys just as much, so yeah, it's a pity it's not in the Olympics anymore.
How are you going to approach the next couple of years? Obviously, Olympics are a big target. How much are you going to do on the road?
As much as possible, as much as I can. I think the road really complements the track anyway. Like previous Olympic years, you've had people like Pete and G both doing the Giro, so you know there's plenty of room for it. And you know, I've got a lot of aspirations on the road as well, but I think the track's such an opportunity as well. So try to get a good balance between the both of them, but ultimately try to be successful at both of them.
You were reportedly offered a contract by Europcar. How big a decision was that to turn that down?
Yeah, pretty big. You know, obviously there's loads of stuff coming out at the moment about Europcar and the situation they're in. And you know, I think for my future, my development, I think the pathway I've chosen is a good one. And like I said, I love the track, and it's that's why I've had most of my success. And you know, I think if you're ever going to do the track, it's the best time to do it is when you're young.
It was actually weird the other day. I came down to breakfast, and we had Ross Edgar there, Jason Quigley, Sir Chris Hoy, and then Vicky Pendleton. And I was like, it's the Olympic team. We're all back together again, which was nice. Like, it's always nice seeing the old faces and just sort of getting those memories back from what it was like at 2012.
Laura, you're still, the team pursuit is obviously the big priority. Do you do no training at all really for the Omnium, or are you starting to do a little bit of bunch training and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm starting to do a little bit more now. Like I say, it's getting harder and harder just to specialise in the event, because sort of every point matters now, because obviously if you win, and then second place is now 2 points rather than it just tallying up. So it is actually quite difficult just to rely on like pure speed, as it were. So yeah, I am starting to work a little bit more now.
And do you feel that's helping you? I mean, you rode a very good points race there, and obviously you won the scratch race. Do you feel you're getting better at those events?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I think all the work that Chris Newton's put in and has really helped. And I would never have expected to win the Commonwealth Games points race. Like, that was a massive confidence boost for me. And since then, I've just sort of carried that on and carried on working with Chris, knowing exactly what I've got to do. And like I say, that was the first scratch race I've actually ever won in an Omnium. So to do that, it really did help set up a good Omnium. I want to win every race that I go into, whether that's a good thing or not. I know Shane doesn't think that is a good thing, because if I don't win, I'm then really disappointed and I take it all a bit to heart, I guess. Yeah, but I'm a bike rider. Like, I think any athlete, whenever they enter a competition, of course you want to win. Like, that's just our mentality. But I do see what Shane means. He said to me once that my desire will be what kills me, not the fact that I haven't got the ability. And I can see that, because sometimes I do just get so wrapped up in the race, and when I don't win, I just get this sense of disappointment.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at @cycling_podcast.
Okay, so we're just about to wrap it up for this week. My name's Richard Moore with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeburn, for the first time, Rob Hatch. Rob, have you enjoyed joining us? Has this been your commentary voice or your normal conversational voice you've been giving us today?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Quite different.
Are they?
Yeah. Have you enjoyed your debut appearance?
Well, seeing as you promised to buy me lunch, I've given you the proper commentary voice, but we might have to change back to Akron-tonian next time if the promise isn't fulfilled. We've got an espresso out of it, at least. No, listen, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me on, and it's been good fun.
I think you'll be back, Rob. You're a very promising debut.
That's good news. I might have to give up commentary then.
It's fine. Now, okay. You two, you're heading back to the marital home, marital home soon. It's a lovely story how Daniel and Rob came together, and now they're living in domestic bliss. How's it going, Rob?
After about 4 days, beautifully, beautifully well. But he hoovered up last night as well, so fantastic. Got home from work and just missing the tea ready on the table. That's all.
Daniel, is it working out well for you?
So far, so good. Yeah,
brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
And thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboom, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.